Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
And now, the list of things that you can buy at the Chicago Reader store at chicagoreader.com. Things to wear like Chicago Reader hats, t-shirts, bandanas, and face masks. Things for your daily life like the Chicago Reader camping mug, Chicago Reader tote bags, and a Chicago Reader reporter's notebook. Things for you to read like our Reader recipes, the Chicago Reader 420 Companion, our Chicago Reader Best Of book series from journalists Maya Duke-Masaba, Mike Sula, Ben Jarofsky, and Lior Galil, the Chicago Reader coloring book, and the Chicago Reader Stay Home puzzle. Find the Chicago Reader store at chicagoreader.com and show your support for the nation's first free weekly newspaper since 1971.
Bonus segment of Ben Jarofsky Show as I speak. It is today? Friday, April 19th, 2024. Here's a little item that's in the news today before we launch into a discussion that'll be tangentially related. This is from the New York Times business section. Trump firm battle suit over steak. This one, ladies and gentlemen, I think it should be required reading for any literate citizen in the United States of America right now to understand really just on a basic level, capitalism, how insane capitalism is, and capitalists, they're just endlessly fighting. And then the courts, there's whole legions of corporate lawyers who are making good money representing these guys as they battle stuff out in the courts, which consume our tax dollars. Not to make, you know, like, at that point, because we're financing the whole thing. But the two men behind the idea for Donald Trump's Trump Media, Wes Moss and Andy Latinsky, who met Trump when they were on his TV show, The Apprentice. Thanks again for nothing, NBC, for launching Donald Trump's political career. They're suing Trump because they think he's cheating them out of a greater share of Trump Media, which, by the way, is a colossal failure in the stock market. Just so they're suing him to get a greater share of a failing enterprise, and he is also suing them. I forget why he's suing them. I did know when I first read the article. I've read like 10 articles in between. It's so irrelevant in the ultimate scheme of things. It just shows you what a treacherous dude this guy is. He's fighting so many battles on so many fronts. I mean, really, it's an extraordinary, insane human being. He's under indictment in how many court? Four right now, you know, facing jail time, prison time. He's got the hush money trial with Stormy Daniels in New York, and you know, it is the business fraud trial in New York, the records trial in Florida, and then of course the insurrection trial. He's running for president. In the meantime, he's suing his allies who sued him. This is an insane man, ladies and gentlemen. Hey, Republicans, you might want to reconsider. Mitt Romney out there? All right, we can maybe run Romney again. All right, without further ado, I'm going to ask my distinguished guest to introduce himself, and then we're going to launch into a discussion that is tangentially related to the insanity I just talked about. Distinguished guest, introduce yourself.
Thanks, Ben. It is great to be here. I'm David Ferris, Associate Professor of Political Science at Roosevelt University, columnist at Slate and Newsweek, author of It's Time to Fight Dirty, How Democrats Can Build a Lasting Majority in American Politics. And sometimes I think about how Donald Trump in an alternate universe could be just like a contented, old, corrupt predator. If he had never run for president, and like he wouldn't be on trial for anything, probably. And his businesses would not be tied up in litigation. Like, one thing you can be sure of, when you sign a piece of paper involving yourself with Donald Trump, you will eventually end up in court suing him, trying to retrieve your money, or being sued yourself.
Yeah.
That's being, how it ends. That's how it ends. Every how it ends.
Being sued by him in an attempt to keep you from getting your money.
Right.
Because generally his lawsuits are an attempt to block you from getting your money by getting you bogged down in another matter, which will maybe encourage you to settle. Yes. Michael Cohen warned us of this, by the way. Speaking of the hush money trial, Michael Cohen, for years, Trump's lawyer, warned, if you get in bed with Trump, you're going to regret it, he said. I think Stormy Daniels would attest to that. She literally got in bed with Donald Trump.
Right. That's something you really don't want to do, is to literally get in bed with him.
No. Well, Melania, I think she may live to regret it as well. What a character she's married. All right. You have three excellent columns to discuss. And I don't even know if we'll get to all three, because, you know, the two of us, we go down many roads when we start these things. I guess what I'll do is I'll start with, let's just see. Hold on. Let me roll the big. Let's talk about no labels. Okay. You wrote a column that I can't remember, it was Newsweek or Slate. David, in addition to being the professor at Roosevelt, writes for Newsweek and Slate. You were writing about the demise of the No Labels Party while pointing out something that is so obvious, which is that essentially the soul, if you will, the philosophical spirit, if you want to put it that way, of the No Labels Party already exists in the Democratic Party. There is no rational reason why anyone would leave the Democratic Party to form the No Labels Party if everything you want is already in the Democratic Party and personified by President Joe Biden, who's in the White House. So there's an absurdity to the very existence of the No Labels Party that just shows how gaslit we are in America, that we take it serious. And you're like the little boy in this fable who says the emperor has no clothes, pointing this out, David, in the aftermath, in sort of your obituary to the No Labels Party. So why don't you take it a little further and help me try to understand one more aspect of our absurd, gaslit political life.
Yeah, sure. I mean, like, it's like if you go to a restaurant and there's two things on the menu, right? It's like chicken and trout. You sit down, the waiter comes over. Waiter's like, what can I get you? And you're like, listen, I'm not happy with either one of these things. I really want some trout. And the waiter's like, well, it's right there. There's trout on the menu. You know, and you're like, not that one, you know? I don't like that one. I want a very, very slightly different trout. So it's like the whole effort from the beginning has been nonsensical for a variety of reasons. One is that the institutional Democratic Party, not every single member of the Democratic Party, right? But like the party elite, the last two Democratic presidents, last three Democratic presidents have been moderates, right? Willing to sign the kind of like budget compromises that the No Labels people like lie awake at night fantasizing about, like starving old people and stuff. They want institutionalists who are committed to norms and bipartisanship and decorum. And that's what the president is, you know, like that's Joe Biden's whole shtick. I mean, we've spent a lot of time criticizing it on this show because I think in some ways it's delusional, but the reality is that Biden has a series of bipartisan accomplishments, you know, the CHIPS and Science Act and the rewriting of the Electoral Count Act and the, Respect for Marriage Act, they called it, you know, not like every other day, right? But he has enough bipartisan accomplishments, plus a posture that has been bipartisan since the 2020 campaign. Like if you think back to the 2020 Democratic National Convention, it was essentially like the Republican National Convention, just full of former Republicans. You know, they gave John Kasich the first night primetime speaking slot. I mean, there were no speaking slots fundamentally at the DNC. It was all like a pre-taped. So it was such a nightmare, I remember. But look, I mean, I guess the point is that like you have a potential third party that doesn't want to hang any ideological labels on itself, but occupies like very clear ideological space that's already occupied in America. You know, it's like fiscally moderate, socially liberal, not too outrageous on anything. That pretty much describes the mainstream of the Democratic Party. And as much as you and I might like to change some of that, that's the reality. So to run a third party candidate against a president who represents like 90% of your issue positions, in as much as you have in issue positions and you want to write them down, which is another problem with this group, it just never made any sense, right? It was like, let's bring Joe Manchin out as the bipartisan moderate alternative to Biden. And it's like, Joe Manchin has basically been Joe Biden's co-president, you know? Like, he has spiked a couple of things that Biden wanted to do, but fundamentally, there's not that much daylight between these guys, you know? And so the effort vaporized because people looked at polling and they realized that in almost every iteration of a three-way matchup with Trump, Biden, and some no-labels person, the no-labels candidate takes away from Biden and you're going to help elect Trump. And even to the dying days of this effort, they would not admit this. You know, what they said was that, well, if we see polling, you know, if we think this is going to help elect Trump, then we won't do it. And they never actually backed away from the idea that they weren't going to hurt Trump. The problem was they couldn't find anyone to take their nomination. You know, they wanted Manchin, they wanted Sinema, they wanted Larry Hogan, former governor of Maryland. Maybe John Huntsman. Like, I'm sure they went down the list of every, you know, quote unquote maverick of the last 20 years and asked them to run, and they wouldn't do it. We had joked last time about how Joe Lieberman would take the nomination, but he died. That is not funny. Okay. But he is no longer alive. He can't take the nomination anymore. So, but he, you know, Lieberman was part of this effort. Remember how Lieberman appeared at the 2008 Republican National Convention for John McCain? Remember this? Yes. He was gonna, if he hadn't been charmed by Sarah Palin over that weekend, Lieberman would have been the Republican vice presidential pick in 2008. Okay. And that has always been the sort of the takeaway of this group. Is that you have it's a group that's positioning itself precisely in the center, but its impact would be to help the right? And that's what Lieberman did in 2008. Okay? He's like, I'm a centrist, but here I am, the Republican National Convention, trying to convince you to elect Sarah Palin as the vice president of the United States. So anyway, these guys.
So why did they exist?
It's like... it's like this never-ending impulse of, like, I call it McCainism, you know, like the idea that the perfect solution to every problem in America is to take the Democratic position and the Republican position, split it down the middle, and enact it into law. That, you know, the idea that we shouldn't argue about policy, right? We should just, like, do things. The idea that, like, debates or ideological differences or sharp disagreements about important things are destructive, rather than like our institutions don't work right. it's the idea of ideological competition itself that is the problem. And there have always been people in DC who are uncomfortable with anyone making a case for serious change on the right or the left. And my take on No Labels the whole time has been, if you go and you read their manifesto, which is hilariously shallow, like takes almost no position. You're like, police violence. We believe that fewer people should be shot. It's like, oh, wow. You know, that's super duper radical. Thank you. At the core of everything No Labels is austerity. You know, like what it all boils down to is like a political party built around the Simpson-Bowles Commission, you know, like a bipartisan Senate gang of eight. Their marching orders are to like cut some fat out of the federal budget and reduce the deficit. And that, I think, in the end is all they actually cared about, was they were debt scolds, austerity hawks, the kind of people who were responsible for the limp response to the Great Recession, that prolonged the suffering of the Great Recession. Right? If you compare the Great Recession to the COVID stuff, right? The fact that we injected a bazillion dollars into the economy 4 years ago is what has kept things moving and restored employment to what it was before the pandemic in very short order. Whereas the Great Recession lasted, you know, a half a decade or longer because Obama had to compromise with these deficit hawks to water down the response. And that watering down, that's what No Labels is, you know. They are an institutional force for like spending less money, cutting the social safety net. Right? It's never like, let's trim the military budget. It's always like, ooh, Social Security is a ticking time bomb. It's just the same stuff since I was like 10 years old. The same arguments being made, the debt bomb, all this stuff. And that's what they are. I mean, they want to find politicians, put them into office, who will agree to dramatically cut the U.S. social spending budget. That's what they want.
And I agree with you. But they don't say it. And so, since they're not upfront about why they exist and their ultimate purpose for existing, they contribute to the ongoing gaslighting of America. And they do that by pretending as though there is a spirit of bipartisanship that exists in America that both parties are guilty of violating, when in fact, any objective analysis of our system will show that it is the Republican Party that is the one that's rejecting a bipartisanship. In fact, every single accusation against Joe Biden that the lefties who come on my show articulate in order to justify why they're not going to vote for Joe Biden is a result of him compromising and being bipartisan.
Mm-hmm.
With the possible, and I have it in quotes, and it's a strain, exception of abortion, we'll get into that. You cannot make that same accusation against Donald John Trump. You can't. Joe Biden has been a bipartisan compromise. I will articulate the other side's point of view when I think it's convenient, or maybe I even believe in it, politician, since he entered the Senate in 1971 or two, or whenever it was that he entered the Senate, David. And so it's just to pretend like this false equivalency that both parties are guilty of violating a spirit that doesn't exist at all, to me, contributes to the gaslighting of America, because I hear Americans saying, I don't know who to vote for. Why can't they get along? They're all the same when they go to Washington. I'm like, no, you cannot possibly say Marjorie Taylor Greene is the same as Akeem Jeffries. I'm sorry. Help me here, David. Help me.
No. And the other thing that drives me crazy is like, look, I don't walk around all day just thinking about the national debt or anything. I think it's wildly overblown.
Yeah.
But if that was your thing, if you were like, I think the number one issue facing America is the debt. The three people most responsible for all of our collective debt are Ronald Reagan, George W. Bush, and Donald Trump, right? Like those three dudes rang up like 90% of the debt that we're living under. And like, do you remember back to the 2000 election that revolved around how we should spend all our extra money?
Yeah. What was the argument?
Al Gore was going to put it in a lockbox. George W. Bush was going to give it back to us. But the point was like, guess what? The budget got balanced under a Democratic president. And the Republicans come in and they cut the taxes. They dramatically decrease revenue, and then they run around screaming about how we're spending too much money.
Yeah. By the way, that in itself is an example of bipartisanship.
Right.
That in itself, Al Gore buying into the notion that the budget has to be balanced, therefore we can't afford health care. Remember, Gore, Clinton abandoned health care because it was too difficult to pay, and they just dropped it. And nobody picked it up again until Bernie in 2016. So that just illustrates how the Democrats have been bending over backwards. And if they lose this election, David, it's probably because the left has completely and utterly abandoned them, which I don't see happening, even despite all the rhetoric of the day, because of the very things you're saying. Yeah. You know?
The progressive left wants to see the government do new and innovative things to address inequality and social problems, right? And more often than not, Democratic presidents and presidential candidates have been willing to be like, yeah, let's hold the line, you know, like, well, I'll balance the budget with you. Joe Biden would do it. If you sent him a bill that, like, you know, did some cuts to Social Security and Medicare in exchange for Democratic priorities and it like brought down the deficit, he would sign that bill, and you know he would, right? The fact that we have a dysfunctional Congress is not his fault. And so it's like, you know, they're searching for the dream centrist, and the dream centrist is just sitting right in front of them the whole time. It's Joe Biden. It's who he's been his whole life. And I think that's why the effort went nowhere, ultimately. And it also went nowhere because no one actually likes this kind of politics, man.
That's another point you make in the essay, which is really a telling point. Everybody pledges their love for it as a myth. I think it was like 82%. I'm doing this off the top of my head. You cited a poll. And then in reality, no Republican can win in a Republican primary these days unless they adopt Donald Trump's scorched earth view of the world. So voters may say, oh, yeah, this is what we want. But they don't deliver when it comes to particularly MAGA or Republican voters.
No, when push comes to shove, they want what they want. I mean, they'll tell a pollster, I support bipartisan compromise. Like, I want my representative to compromise rather than sticking to their beliefs. And then when they get into the office, and you're like, okay, you want a balanced budget? What if we closed a military base in South Carolina? And they're like, no, not that kind of compromise. When you said balanced budget, I assume you meant like. Put pensioners out on the street, not close a military base. That's crazy. So,
unless
politics actually appeals to anybody, you know.
Unless I'm the pensioner being put out on the street, not me. Then the other guy, like we had utter act of absurdity, and I'll really show restraint here. Is when it came to the fair tax referendum that the good citizens of Illinois had to embrace, pensioners. On the northwest and southwest side of Chicago voted against it. They voted against it on the grounds that would possibly lead to them having to contribute taxes from their pensions, even though it would fortify their pensions. They voted against their own interests. All right. So anyway, don't get me started. All right. So we know that this was a very strange political movement. And good riddance. Now explain something to me. I need to understand this. Why is Larry Hogan running for... You mentioned him, and it just triggered this. So Larry Hogan was the more or less moderate governor of the state of Maryland who took pride in that he was not Trump. And now he is no longer governor. He's running for as a Republican, not as a no labels guy who's going to caucus with the Democrats. As a Republican, he's running. I'm like, what is he thinking? I do not understand. If you believe, as he's supposed to do, that Trump is the greatest existential threat our country faces, why would you run for Senate and that would invariably give him more power if you were part of the movement that tilted the Senate from Democrat to Republican? What kind of gaslighting has going on in Larry Hogan's mind? Help me understand this, David.
It's the same thing going on with Sununu, the governor of New Hampshire, who I know spent 8 years saying how much he disliked Donald Trump and then just went and endorsed him. When you scratch beneath the surface, their ambition is more important to them than the sense that they think that Donald Trump is a threat to the Republic or whatever, you know? Maybe to be extra generous to Larry Hogan, maybe he's one of these people who thinks like if they get into power, they can help mitigate the damage of a Donald Trump, you know, like the way that people would take jobs in the Trump administration and be like, well, you know, if it's not me, then they'll just give the job to Charlie Kirk or whatever. Right. So I'm doing God's work here by serving the Trump administration. You can tell yourself that story. I think the reality is, Larry Hogan had higher ambitions than being the governor of Maryland. There's really nowhere else to go except into the Senate because he knows he wouldn't be competitive in a national Democratic primary for the presidency. So he wants to stay in politics. He got talked into it by leading Republicans who spun him whatever tale they wanted to about their internal polling about how he'd be competitive. But the reality, he's going to lose that race by 10, 15 points. It'll all be for nothing. There's a long history recently of the parties trying to win Senate races in landslide states for the other party by running popular former governors. And the basic dynamic, this isn't political science for you. People are just more willing to split their tickets for governors than for senators. Especially in a presidential election year, right? Like you're just running up against this buzzsaw of party ID and partisanship that like people are still willing in a lot of places to vote for the other party for a governor if they, you know, if they're dissatisfied enough with their own, with the existing governor, the existing party, they are still willing to put other people in power at the state level. But when it comes to the Senate, we now have like six or seven cases in a row where you've got this like former governor who managed to be popular. It'd be the same thing if Andy Beshear ran for president. Ran for Senate from Kentucky. Right. It's like, they're like, Andy Beshear, like, he's cracked the code. He knows how to appeal to Kentuckians. It's like, no,
cracked the code.
Not at the national level, right? As soon as you bring national politics into it, people's partisanship snaps back into place. And like, yeah, I'm sure Larry Hogan will do better than a generic Republican would do in Maryland, but better is not enough in a state where Democrats win, you know, win the presidency by 15, 20 points. Right. So, it's just not going to work. Right. Like, and I'm sure that I'm guessing Larry Hogan thinks he can win, you know, and this has been a pattern. The initial polls will show the person competitive. What was the guy in Montana that ran for Senate in 2020? He was a former governor. Anyway, it'll come to me. But like, you know, we have one of these people after another, right, that have tried to do this, failed to do this. And this will be the same. It'll be the same ending for Larry.
Yeah. And by the way, when you say generic Republican, he is a generic Republican in Maryland. But what you're saying is that he thinks he could do better because he's not MAGA, but he will be forced to defend MAGA to get MAGA votes. And then he will be forced to convince Democrats that just because he's defending MAGA votes doesn't mean he's MAGA. And then when you add the issue of abortion and Supreme Court nominations and in the mix, yes, it's I'm wondering if Susan Collins could win re-election in this particular. When did she last run?
It was 2020.
2020. Okay.
And she was down deep in the polls. And then she pulled out that like huge shock on election day, which she went by 9 points or something.
Yeah.
The day after the election in 2020, I was like, I give up. I give up trying to beat Susan Collins. Like, I don't get it, but I give up. They love her. God bless. You know,
yeah.
She dies.
Yeah.
The only way to get rid of Susan Collins is she is getting old. So
I remember that was one of the prediction comment. You went down the Senate seats in 2020 and, mm-hmm. and you had the Democrats defeating Susan Collins.
For sure.
That's okay. We all see some of the predictions I've made down through the years. Thank God. You don't know of them. All right. We've mentioned abortion. Let's get to the second column of yours I want to discuss. You're analyzing Donald Trump's effort to thread the needle on abortion, and it's really kind of funny to watch them struggle on it, because it just exposes the inconsistency, to put it mildly, of the Republican attitude about abortion, how they've ceded this issue over to these zealots who articulate a worldview about life beginning at the moment of fertilization that 90% of America, if you really pushed them on it, would say, no, I don't believe in that. And yet, because the zealots control the Republican Party, everyone from Donald Trump on down has to sort of pay homage to that bit of insanity. So Donald Trump is trying to thread the needle by saying, what exactly? Help me understand Donald Trump's message to win over swing voters on this issue of abortion.
You know, this whole thing, like the idea that Donald Trump cares about babies, I mean, he doesn't even like his own children, you know? So it's like, give me a break, man. I mean, this guy, just a lifelong, you know, philanderer and perpetrator of sexual misconduct. There's the idea that this is the guy that has become the darling of the pro-life community. Look, I mean, look, Donald Trump was responsible for appointing the Supreme Court majority that blew apart the Roe consensus. Okay, go back to No Labels for a second. They have their manifesto. They're like, you know, actually, most Americans are moderate on abortion, and I believe that, you know, it should be legal under some circumstances and illegal under others. And I was like, that's what Roe was. Jesus Christ. That's the consensus that the Republicans blew apart. Yeah. You're a Democrat, man. Yeah. So it's like, look, he did this. He doesn't actually personally believe in the pro-life cause. You know, he was not pro-life. He wasn't an anti-choice extremist before he became president, probably out of personal necessity. But he did this, right? He's the one that he took the Federalist Society judges list. He put them into office. And then those people have imposed this like reproductive tyranny dystopia on us in half the states in America. And it's become a real problem for Republicans because Republicans are getting clobbered. Every time abortion is put directly in front of voters, they vote for abortion and against this new regime of tyranny that's been imposed on people in the United States. And that puts Donald Trump in a very awkward position, right? Because you have like people in the Republican Party are not dumb. They know that this is costing them electorally. Trump, as much as you can get into that thick skull of his and get a complete sentence out, he's aware that it's a political liability for him. And he's been biding his time and saying different things in private to different people about what he would or wouldn't support. I think there was some thinking he would come out in support of a 15-week national abortion ban, right? Which is not what I support, but interestingly, like not that far outside of where public opinion is about this. But instead he was like, I'm going to leave it to the states. And you could not have scripted this better, Ben. Right. Because he goes out and he's like, some of this stuff's too far. You know, I support exceptions for rape and incest and this stuff. And, some of that, like, well, just the people will figure it out at the state level. And I think it was the next day.
Yes, it was the next day. Yes.
The Arizona Supreme Court.
Yes. It was the next day.
We're going to uphold this 1864 yeah. statute that was written before Arizona was a state. I could convey like an exclamation point in parentheses for my audience. Like, you know, like just this unbelievable stuff, right?
Yeah.
Arizona Supreme Court's like, we're just going to ban all abortion based on a Civil War era statute that was written before statehood. And everybody was like, oh, so you want to leave it to the states. So this, right? And then he had to come back out and be like, well, I mean, you know, they'll, I didn't mean that kind of state. They'll clean it. I mean,
they'll clean it up.
Yeah. They'll clean it up. They'll clean it. I mean, even Carrie Lake was like, the Arizona Senate candidate, who's a complete lunatic, was like, yeah, no, this is too far. But the Arizona State Legislature was like, actually, no, this is not too far. This is exactly what we wanted.
No, they twice have buried attempts to get rid of it.
Yeah. Because this is what Republicans want. Okay. It may not really be like Donald Trump personally wants, but this is what Republicans want. And he'll do whatever Republicans tell him to. He doesn't care.
Well, you've gone into the mind of Donald Trump when you now try to decipher whether you're in the mind of Donald. Wow. Be careful. It's dangerous in that little brain. But so what Donald Trump personally believes is irrelevant in this particular argument I would make, because he is going to follow the dictates of MAGA on this point, while trying to convince them. And this one is hilarious. I don't know if you watch Comedy Central, but they did this bit about explaining the Republican position on abortion, which I will send to you. I should have sent to you before we did the show. Anyway, and they had clipping as they try this nuanced position where they're against abortion, but for it at the same time, trying to thread that needle. And they showed like Fox commentators saying, what's the big deal if you live in a state that's outlawed abortion? All you got to do is get on an airplane and fly to another state and get your abortion. And I'm like, is this the argument? Is this the defense, the fly to Illinois argument? You don't even fly to New York. By the way, they're trying to outlaw it in Illinois and New York too, just so you know. Help me out on this, David. Go ahead.
Yeah, look, I mean, one point I'll make here is like, imagine this, like, we're going to ban vasectomies in Illinois, but you can get one in New York. Yeah. Go ahead, go fly to New York, get a vasectomy and fly back. Does that sound like fun to you?
No.
So it's...
Wow.
I'm finished having children. yeah, it's a preposterous argument, right? It's like, look, these guys obviously want to make it impossible for people to travel to other states to get abortions, right? There's all kinds of ideas floating around out there. There's the Texas stuff where they're going to put bounties on people for taking them out of state for an abortion. You've got all these like Handmaid's Tale zealots like want to track women's periods and stuff, and just, you know, like just insane stuff. Like you give these guys runway, they will figure out a way to make it difficult to impossible for people in Texas to obtain an abortion in Illinois. That's like they're hell bent on this because they have the legal regime. You know, they have total dominance of some of these states, and they're going to trot out every possible strategy until the Supreme Court signs off on one and makes it even harder to do this. They also have Donald Trump's ideological allies in the Project 2025 movement. All these conservative think tanks, you know, want to go after like abortion pills, and you know, like they want to make it harder and harder and harder and harder, which actually they've been doing since the 80s, right? Chipping away at reproductive rights, one little thing at a time, right? Until they finally got their victory in Roe and overturning Roe. And what they want now is total victory. But like the idea that the conservative legal movement is going to stop here and be like, you know what, it's fine if abortion is still legal in like 22 states. That's totally fine. Yeah, we don't care anymore. Just let it go. They're not going to let it go. They're never going to let it go. Right? And like when push comes to shove, we both know whatever he personally thinks, Donald Trump would sign a 6-week abortion ban. Because he's a megalomaniac. All he really wants is to be president. He doesn't care what happens when he's president, right? He's golfing or he's tweeting. And he has to appoint people who know like a little bit of something about like American politics and democracy to run the country. And he appoints those people, and they are all right-wing zealots who come out of like the Heritage Foundation and like the American Greatness Foundation, whatever these little think tanks that have arisen to do Trump's handiwork for him. The reality is like most of the policy at the state level, most of the policy at the national level is written by think tanks and lobbyists and advocacy groups. They put it in front of the president. They put it in front of our members of Congress, and they mindlessly put it through.
Yeah. All right. So help me with this dimension of this issue. The consensus seems to be from the mainstream political pundits. Is that if the Democrats are to prevail in November, abortion will carry them to victory, an electoral college victory. They'll probably win the popular vote victory anyway, but we'll get into the electoral college in a little while, ladies and gentlemen. That's a tease. But it'll be abortion. So let's assume that for once the mainstream political pundits are correct and that abortion will be the issue that brings independent swing voters to vote for Biden and defeat Trump in Arizona, Georgia, Nevada, et cetera, and so forth, where he needs to win these states. I'm like, what does that say about our country? That abortion, I'm pro-choice. I'm just get this out of the way right now. I find abhorrent all the laws that Texas, Mississippi, and Florida, et cetera, and so forth, are adopting, Arizona, et cetera. But I also view, like, the rest of existence beyond this one issue and just the character of Donald John Trump on trial as I began, four different venues, his business face, his former partner, they're suing each other, you know, the rape trial, et cetera, and so forth. An attempted coup that we all witnessed. David, it's like, why is it coming down to abortion?
Yeah, I mean, it goes back to what we've all been saying since 2015, right? Which is like, you take anything this guy has said or done in the last 9 years, and just that should be enough. If there was like a thing that used to get sent around on Twitter like every 3 days back when there was a Twitter before Elon Musk destroyed the thing. And it was like, they would tweet out that clip of Donald Trump mocking people with disabilities. Remember he did it? Like this 2015 campaign. And you know, he did the whole impression of someone, and they were like, this right here, this should have been it.
Yeah.
Right. Like in a sane country, somebody gets out and mocks people with disabilities in public. That should have been the end of it. And that's true. You know, you talked about the insurrection. Yeah. The man tried to, he perpetrated a coup on national television.
Yeah.
Like we all sat there watching, we're trapped in our basements. It was like mid pandemic. He did a national coup. He on a phone call, recorded phone call.
Yes.
Blackmailed the president of a friendly Democratic country to try to extort information out of that person to beat his likely Democratic opponent. Fall. I mean, we only have so much time here, right? Like I could go on, but like there's like 15 or 20 things that Donald Trump has said or done as president in his life that should be fully disqualifying from like sitting on a school board, let alone being the president of the United States, you know? But we've talked a number of times, I think, about what we call the status quo bias in American politics, right? That is Americans' tendency to not take dramatic change very well, for there will always be a backlash when that dramatic change happens. And abortion is a case, I think, really more extraordinary case of the disruption of the status quo, in the sense that you had a right that was enjoyed by people for more than 50 years.
Yeah.
Was it 50? I said it was about 50. But, you know, I mean, abortion was legal in some states prior to Roe, right? So, but like from Roe to Dobbs is 50, it's about 50 years.
Yes.
There were people who were born into this world and only knew this world. And all of a sudden, abortion is illegal in their state. And I don't think it's just that. I think it's all the other downstream secondary knock-on effects that have happened as a consequence of outlawing abortion in some of these states. You know, I have a friend who wrote this really searing essay for Newsweek about how she couldn't get a DNC in Texas because they were afraid of getting arrested when she was miscarrying. And it's just like these kind of horror stories, just one after another, right? It's not everywhere, right? Like, it's not like all other, but if there's enough of these stories where like doctors who are afraid to save people's lives or to do things that are not abortion, because abortion is illegal, that I think is adding to the sense that Republicans have gone way too far. And, you know, whether this one issue is going to carry us across the finish line in November, I can't say. But what I can say is when you take a right away from people, you're going to pay for it, you know? And I'll tell you this, like, I want to go after the Second Amendment as much as anybody, Ben. And I hope someday we get a liberal Supreme Court majority that, like, claws back all this insane jurisprudence of the last 30 years. But I'll tell you, I wouldn't not expect a backlash. You know what I mean? Like if we claw back some of this Second Amendment jurisprudence, there's going to be a backlash. You know, there might be an electoral price to pay. That's for sure. And here you have a case where we're on the right side and they're on the wrong side of both of these issues. I just think it's been so unsettling for so many people to live in this new world, to know that they're raising their kids in this new world where you can't get an abortion. And when you outlaw abortion, right, you can't just like, it's not like you're hitting pause on it and you can just like spool the whole thing back up, right? Like people stop going and specializing in these things, right? All the doctors who perform abortions are going to leave your state and they're not coming back, right? So there's in some sense a realization that you can't just unwind this thing overnight, right? Like the damage that this has done since Dobbs will take a decade to unwind. And that's if, you know, that's if we win, right? I wish the other stuff were enough too, but I guess it took this to open people's eyes to what the real dangers are here. And of course, they're not going to stop at abortion, right? It's birth control, it's IVF, it's gay marriage. They're coming after all this stuff, you know, one after the other.
You know, that point you said, Republicans have gone too far. And apparently this is the only issue in which middle-of-the-road voters, I don't know what else to call them, independent swing voters, whatever you want to call them, have decided, yes, they've gone too far. So calling the Secretary of State in Georgia and asking him to throw away the votes that Biden got in order to leave, asking the election boards in Michigan to throw out the votes from Detroit because, you know, black people voted for Biden. So we'll just get rid of all those votes. You know, that's not too far. Okay. You know what I'm saying? I'm like, wow. Okay. But this is too far. And I'm with you. It is too far. I'm just saying to me, add to the list.
Yeah.
You know, wow. But this is the one. So like our democracy hinges on this issue and hinges on the ability or the lack of the inability of Republicans to figure out a way to have it both ways. Mm-hmm. I don't believe they can come up with a way because there is no way. And you can't
You can't dedicate yourself to the worldview of the zealots who believe all abortions are murders and still allow a woman to get an abortion.
Right. And you know what the terrible thing is here is that these, I actually think these like rat bastards could get away with it too. If they would actually govern as like pro family people, you know what I mean? There's always you remember this column like Ross Douthat or whatever was like, now's the time for a pro-natalist policy from the Republican Party. We're going to subsidize daycare, do paid family leave, and support parents. And it's like, they did none of that stuff. They can't get anybody to sign on to it in the party.
I have almost as much disdain for those types of conservatives who I've been reading their columns for about 30 years now as I do for the no-label people. Because there's no world where Republicans rule where they show compassion to poor people, where they show compassion to women who there's no husband in the house, no man in the house. It's a single parent household. I've never seen any evidence of the best they could come up with is get thee to a nunnery and we'll give a tax break to the heads of the nunnery. And so to pretend as though this is coming down the pike, David, like there's this exchange, is to promote a non-existent thing. So when you said that, it just triggered me. I'm like, yeah, I've read those columns.
I mean, I just don't think that they understand the magnitude of like the alteration of your life trajectory that having a baby imposes on people. I've got two kids. I love them to absolute pieces. I wouldn't do anything different. Right. But like, it costs like somewhere in the neighborhood of like $600,000 to $800,000 to raise a child in America, first of all. Right. And second of all, like people, like the greater the magnitude of the change that you're imposing on people, and the more it affects them personally in their day-to-day lives, the more likely it is to be politically resonant or salient. And when you're telling people, I will force you to have a baby, it's just like, man, it's just, you've never thought about what it means to have a baby then, have you? Right? Like you've never thought about what it means physically to bring a child into the world. You ever watched a live human childbirth, Ben? It's like, I don't know how you can believe in God after it. You know, it's like, it's really disturbing. You know, it's hard on people. It is very hard on the people that bring the child into the world. To say to people, like, we are going to deprive you of the right to make that massive, like, life-altering choice about whether to bring another life into the world. And, like, if they weren't expecting a backlash, I don't know what to tell them. You know, people are just not going to sit with this. You know, are we going to win in November? I don't know. But this issue's not going away.
Yeah. Well, for what it's worth, I had a very much of a mainstream Democrat on the show yesterday, a pretty astute political analyst who I very rarely agree with because he's much more to the center than I am. And he says all of his projections are that things are swinging Biden's way. So for what it's worth, Peter Cunningham said it on this show. And this guy comes from the ROM Daily School, so maybe he knows something I don't know. He's usually on the winning sides of elections, and I'm on the losing sides of
things look better than they did the last time I was on the show. I'll give him that. You know, we don't have it in the bag, but like things have gotten a couple of points better, which is very encouraging. So,
all right. Well, listen, it's an encouraging sign. Let's leave it on an optimistic note. I did want to talk to you about your column on the National Popular Vote. Can't even read my writing. Compact, which essentially would do away the Electoral College. It's something I must admit to ignorance, folks. I did not know this thing existed until I read David's column, and I go, man, am I ignorant? I should have known this. Now I'm going to pretend like I knew it all along. Yeah, of course. This is passed in Maine. Yeah, everybody knows that.
I've been working for this for years.
I didn't even know about it. Fascinating. It's a sort of a backdoor way to get rid of the Electoral College. So we'll talk about it in a future time because you know me, David. I love talking about the Electoral College. But in the meantime, I urge everybody to read David's column. I think that's was that Slate or Newsweek? I can't remember which one.
This one was in News. The Electoral College was in Newsweek.
Read it, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah.
It must have gotten on like Real Clear Politics or something because I've got like 50 emails from like these weirdos who are like, America's a republic, not a democracy kind of people. You know what I mean? Those folks. So yeah, we should do a whole episode. We'll do a whole episode on like structural bias, like what's going to happen this year. We'll do the popular vote compact, the constitutionality. It'd be fun.
Yeah, that'll be fun. And ladies and gentlemen, anybody who says that is really just a Republican pretending they're not a Republican. Okay. I know that game. All right, David, thank you so much. I'll let you get to where you got to go. And then I'll see you next week. All right.
Sounds good. Thanks, Ben. Great to be on the show.
That's David Ferris. I'm Ben Drofsky. Take care, everybody.